From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a podcast that's helping listeners refine their sense of hearing. It's called 20,000 Hertz, and it's about sound, like the first sound recorded, or what sound is like in space, or a sound on the border of Canada that makes people sick. The creator and host of the podcast, Dallas Taylor, will be with us, and of course, we'll play some tape. After this.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a podcast devoted completely to sound. It's not one of those geeky audiophile shows. It's the stories behind the most recognizable and interesting sounds in history. And the host and producer, Dallas Taylor, has said that even though we're surrounded by sound, of course, our sense of hearing may be one of the most neglected of our senses. So Taylor wants to do for sound what Anthony Bourdain did for food, put it in a cultural context, explain how people live with it, how it influences our lives and our bodies. Put it this way, he's helping people refine their taste in sound. Today in the program, Dallas Taylor is joining us to talk about sound and his podcast. It's called 20,000 Hertz. Taylor is a sound designer and an audio mixer. He's founder and creative director of DeFacto Sound. It's a sound design company for films and television and video games and more. They're based in New York. Dallas Taylor is joining us today. And Dallas, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
I wanted to begin by asking, how do you describe your relationship with sound? Not just the career part, we'll get to that, but like go back. When did you, if you can even remember this, when did you first become aware of sound?
Well, when I was in school, the one thing that I really was only good at was playing the trumpet, of all things. I grew up in a really impoverished school and didn't really love school. But now things have changed. But back then, the one thing that really got me through this really difficult kind of upbringing was this trumpet that somehow the school had a band program, and I became really good at it and kind of excelled. And that's what kind of took me into college. And through all that time, obviously a lot of what I was thinking about was music.
Yeah.
But that kind of morphed eventually.
How did it morph? I mean, I know you've talked about that the performance part kind of fell by the wayside for you in terms of music. So at what point did you start getting interested in the post audio part and the sound part?
Well, there's a transition in college where I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. I started to struggle with some really bad performance anxiety. And at the time, I didn't really know how to manage that. And I was looking for ways to still be creative in this field. But I just started looking around, and I love tech. And I was playing around with MIDI and all the little like new gadgets and computer programs and stuff. Thought I was going to go down to into the music recording route. But once I kind of got into that world a little bit, I didn't particularly love the culture. I found pretty quickly that there was this whole other side of sound where people were making all of the stuff that you hear in movies, like all the Foley and all the booms and hits and all of these things. So that interested me. And I found myself in a very zigzaggy way getting over into that world by way of television and doing live TV for news. That's what's kind of led me over to spending some time in LA, getting all these really cool hands-on experience of just making really cool sounds and impactful things, really making these kind of documentaries and things come to life on the sound front. And then one thing led to another, and it just kind of pushed me all the way into doing this for myself and working with a lot of advertising agencies and a lot of other networks and video games and all of that stuff.
Yeah. You started DeFacto Sound about 9 years ago now. At what point along the line did you start thinking about wanting to tell the stories behind the sound and the idea of a podcast? When does that come to you?
It was really shortly after. I was really inspired early on by 99% Invisible.
Yeah.
And I would eat up every story that Roman told that had to do with sound. They were just so perfectly crafted and just beautiful. And he romanticized all this design that influenced me in the way that I started my own business. But it was really early on. And the reason that it just took so long to really continue on that was because I never wanted to step on his toes. I never wanted to just kind of like do a copycat or like, oh, this is 99% Invisible Part 2. But over the years, that show really morphed into something that was just bigger than all of that. It was, if there was one kind of focus, it's really the architecture side of it. Well, they still do some sound stories. So I eventually found out that there was just plenty of stories that could essentially be 99PI stories, but there's enough stories to fill years and years and years. As of right now, we have something like 300 plus great show ideas just sitting in the queue. And so I just knew that there was so much content here because I live it. And in my world, we're always talking about different ways to use sound for an emotional impact, you know, with different people and different styles. And we're always trying to communicate to different crowds and things. And so we just had at the studio just had these stories just stewing. And yeah, it just took a while for us to for me and the team to really have the bandwidth and the time and not feel like we're really kind of like taking over for another established show.
Why do you figure that there hadn't been a podcast like yours before, you know, telling stories behind sound? I find that interesting because there's so many podcasts.
Yeah. I often say that this to me is the world's most obvious podcast.
Yes.
Because it's mind blowing, really. At DeFacto Sound, one of the things I do a lot of speaking and stuff on sound. And one of the things that I say is just like the narrative and the emotional impact of sound is just so powerful. And I really wanted to show a way to do that. And the perfect medium was the sound only medium to really show how can this sense affect people. And it's just odd. I think that in the industry that I was in, maybe I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder because in the industry that I'm in, there's only two senses that these people have to tell stories, and that's sight and hearing. And oftentimes being in my world, which was maybe, you know, 2-4% of a budget, it was just so put on the back burner. It was just like a finishing thing. It wasn't really thought through. It's like, let's make the most gorgeous pictures we possibly can.
Yeah.
And then let's just shoehorn all the sound at the end. And
right.
So maybe I think part of this in my world was just, it's important. I feel like I'm kind of just banging my head up against the wall because it's something that we all enjoy as a human sense and that it's just not thought about. And I feel like it's really, I mean, I have no data to back this up, but I feel like if you were to rank the five senses, you know, sight being number one, everything in the world is based off of our sight. You can't look anywhere and not see something that's designed, you know, film, TV, graphic design, everything. You have taste, which the entire food industry is, you know, why is taste important? If you know, why is sight important? Why is touch, which is like our clothing and our shoes and our chairs and smell and like, you know, why we don't want to smell sewage or, you know, why we have deodorant and candles. But hearing is one of those things that like, you don't really think like, why is hearing important? Why do we want spaces and things to sound good? So I always kind of see that sense. I've always just felt like that sense was just underappreciated. And it's not anyone's fault, but I think if we can tune into this amazing sense that we all have, that you can kind of get what you get out of those other four senses. Like I love great food. I love comfortable clothes. I love things that smell nice and I appreciate good design. And there's this whole amazing other sense that you can appreciate. And it doesn't have, you don't have to be an audiophile to do that. And I think traditionally like sound has been a thing that like, oh, I'm not allowed to really think about unless I'm an audiophile. And I really want to just open up this entire sense to everyone, and whether it's a kid, an adult, just anyone that could possibly enjoy this.
I want to familiarize our listeners to some of your shows, and I wanted to ask you about – I wanted to start with First Sounds. What got you wondering about the oldest sound recordings? That's what you take on in this podcast. This was from the first season.
Yeah, I think that it had to do with how short of a time in our human history have we had the ability to record and playback.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to just remind myself and other people that it's not that long ago. And even if you hear these recordings, it sounds like a totally different universe. And even if they're only 100 or you know, it just sounds so different. And so really just kind of get a like a timeline of a scale of humanity and where things have adapted and how far we've come in a short amount of time and maybe how far we're going to go from here to the next milestone in 50 years. And I think that was kind of like the original idea for it. And really, when you can hear people back in this period, the history really comes to life.
Yeah. There's an initiative, a First Sounds initiative. Patrick Feaster is the co-founder, and you had him on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he talked about with you was how people in the early days, you know, before when this was novel, you know, recorded sound, the way they would react to recorded sound like on a phonograph. And people didn't know how to deal with or talk to or someone who wasn't actually there, that it must have been really disconcerting.
I think it's a lot like a child reacts the first time they hear themselves or records themselves.
Yeah.
It's this thing that doesn't seem like you should be able to do this. And it's putting a perspective on yourself that's kind of like a mirror. But again, if it's something that it's a sense that you don't think much about, it can be quite a big experience, really.
Do we know, I won't give too much away from the podcast, but what is the oldest playable recording? I have to say I was really surprised. This went back to the 1850s, 1860s.
I don't remember the earliest one. I know it's in the podcast, but I do remember the one that was the most powerful for me, and that was a recording of a slave. It was later in their life. So just hearing the voice of someone who had been a slave really just connected the history with where we are now, what we're struggling with now as a society.
My name is Fountain Hughes. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. And now I am 101 years old.
And so to hear that voice was just really, really powerful. And I don't think that that person may have really understood just the magnitude of what that recording would mean to people now.
You ask in the podcast whether we will find something older. Could something be recovered from, you know, a deep past? I found this really interesting. Patrick Feaster talked about how there's some speculation about how maybe we could extract sound from paintbrushes or marks on pots or even like a dinosaur's tail, like the movement in mud. I find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I would be really interested to see if that could be possible, because sound is just a, you know, you can't really see it. It's invisible, just like air is invisible, but you're constantly like rippling the air, kind of like if you threw a rock in a pond. And so the concept here is if these dinosaurs or whatever were these really loud creatures and maybe going through, you know, soft mud or some mud that's about to solidify, that maybe you could – maybe at least the biggest waves could potentially be recorded in some way on this.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to happen, but it would be amazing. There's also talk that Abraham Lincoln had been recorded at some point, and that would just be an incredible find and would be kind of revolutionary for all of our history, just to hear his voice. And I mean, imagine how powerful that would be if we could hear Abraham Lincoln's voice. Or, I mean, you know, obviously impossible, but George Washington, you can get so much more meaning out of text and words just by hearing the way that they're spoken.
Dallas, I wanted to ask you, one of the first shows you did, and this was one that got a lot of attention, was the show that told the story of the NBC chimes. Where did this idea come from? When did this occur to you?
Well, I didn't realize this until after it had come out, when my wife had said, wow, it's really cool that you kind of did a whole tribute to your first job in television. And this is something that when you start a podcast, it takes so long to kind of pilot and get right. And we had been working on this for 9 months and probably talking about it for years. And so it was something that I didn't realize. But my very first job that I ever got was operating a television camera for a news station at NBC. And then so NBC is what gave me my start. That moved me out to L.A., and that's where I was at the time. A lot of the NBC operations were in Burbank, and so there was The Tonight Show and Days of Our Lives and Access Hollywood and all this. But there was one giant mural that they had that I walked by daily that gave kind of the visual history of NBC and also talked about how important those chimes were. And it was a story that I just always found really fascinating because it was just there to solve a problem at first, like a lot of sounds. It's kind of designed to cover something or just solve some sort of problem. And so in this case, it was basically a sound that would allow for one studio to go to the next. And so if you didn't have a sound that was going to cover that up, all this stuff was analog. And so if you've ever plugged in a guitar cable or something, you'll hear until it kind of connects.
Yeah.
And back then they would have to, on the radio, they'd have to pull physical cables out and push them into another area. And so this was, at the time, I think it was a 7-note sequence, and it was just a little thing that the announcer would play. This is NBC or KNBC or something. And then they'd play ding, 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 ding. And the story is just so fascinating because it's just such a normal human thing. Like the 7 notes were being, it was just the announcers were messing it up. So they'd make a mistake. And so they were like, we got to make this shorter. And so they went down to the 3 notes. And then those 3 notes even have a story, like they're G, E, C. And kind of a common misconception is that GEC stands for the General Electric Corporation, which would make sense because that's their parent company. But it's all just a coincidence. It was GEC before GE ever came along. And they've used those chimes in a way where they would, if there was big news coming in, they would hit the third chime twice. So it'd ding, yeah. Ding, ding, ding. And that would mean that everyone needs to come into the newsroom because there's something big happening, but we've got to figure it out. And so behind all of these sounds, like the EAS alert tone that you hear on your phone or whatever, or UI sounds or the THX deep note or the Wilhelm scream, have all these just incredible, juicy human stories behind them. And it just makes you really appreciate how much care and effort and time went into these little, tiny, short sounds.
You know, that sound, the chimes, as you point out in your podcast, that has been with us for nearly 90 years now. And you say in the podcast that it's pretty much ingrained in our culture at this point. And I'm wondering if you think the chimes still work in the same way. Are they still familiar to this younger generation? Do you wonder if sounds like that are going to fall by the wayside in the digital age?
Not if people are talking about them.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that I'm at least in some way leading that charge. I recently met someone at NPR in Washington. I was just being introduced. Oh, this is a podcast host, 20,000 Hertz. And she had told me that it was fascinating because I guess she knew someone over at NBC Marketing in Universal City and had told me that they are actually using that podcast to remind all of the NBC employees of what those chimes mean. And it was, and this has happened a few times where I'm finding that what we're kind of telling stories behind is now influencing people all over the place. Mm-hmm. I just heard from someone at a huge very recognizable furniture place that said that our audio descriptions episode influenced them to make sure that all of their materials accessible to anyone with disabilities. And it's I think the thing that's the most exciting for me is that generally the podcast listener is someone who's first on the scene with a lot of things. And so it's cool to see that this podcast is getting into these very powerful places and trickling down to where it can kind of influence people in a new way and people understand where the history is. And I think that that's the thing that really is special to me. Whenever I find a big organization or a company that's taking action on something that we maybe told a story about.
There's this theme that comes and goes. It's about paying attention. A number of shows seem to come back to that. I wanted to ask about the analog to digital show. And initially, you know, you're talking about how people found vinyl records, that experience of, you know, the sound of those scratchy grooves, magical. And there's one broadcaster you have in the piece, Rick Adams, talks about how that it sounds alive. And you talk about how DJs were really into that experience of working with a vinyl record. And it was tactile and analog and interesting. And I wanted to play another moment from this podcast. Craig Crane, who works in digital visual effects. And for Craig, vinyl records are kind of this way to relax. He talks about on the podcast how he started to miss analog. And he told you that living and working in this digital world was really taking a toll on him. And he was looking for a way to decompress. And then I'll play this moment from the podcast. He comes across an old Sony Walkman and a cassette.
It was the past just kind of reaching out and grabbing me and pulling me back. I remember where I was when I made that tape. I remember what shops I'd bought the records on that I'd made that mixtape with. It was just total recall. And not only that, but I was listening to this sound. And what really surprised me was that I was actually listening to entire tracks rather than swiping across, you know, next track. Oh, don't like that. Next track. Next track. I was actually listening to this entire cassette, and that's when I just started thinking, you know what? I can't remember the last time I actually just sat down and listened to 90 minutes of continuous music on an iPad or an iPhone or an iPod. That was the genesis of this mission that I am currently on now.
Craig was working on a bunch of films at once and desperately needed some downtime.
It was almost as if I was meant to find that box of tapes and that old Walkman.
The journey started from there. He became obsessed.
I decided to hit eBay, get a cassette deck, get all my vinyl cleaned, and I just started making tapes. And it was a fantastic time because these records I hadn't touched for a good couple of decades. And as soon as you put the needle onto that disc, it just takes you back. It takes you back to some fantastic memories.
Craig said that discovering that cassette tape may have saved his life. You raise this question of what we're losing in this transition from analog to digital. And one of the things you say we have lost is the rituals. This is how you put it, the rituals that prepared us to listen.
Yeah. There's this big debate that it's kind of a bit of an insufferable debate that I've heard just over the years as being kind of in these audiophile and sound designery worlds. And that debate is always like, which sounds better, analog or digital, or which sounds better, vinyl or, you know, a high quality MP3 or WAV file or something. And I've never really identified with that exact argument, because the reality is I've heard records on incredible systems that sound absolutely phenomenal. And I've heard amazing digital recordings that sound absolutely phenomenal too. Technology is just getting so far. And so I never felt like the argument was the right argument. I think it had more to do with the way that we prepare ourselves to listen. So if you think about how we listen now, if you're going to find something new, we have a button that can immediately go to the next track and instantaneously. So if you're not hooked, you know, I don't like this, next track. I don't like this, next track. And so it's something that really interrupts how music was supposed to be listened to. And we wonder why so much about music is so formulaic and all of these things, but we're a product of pushing it in that direction. And so what vinyl and what cassettes did back when we were using them is it just we had to slow down. And no one would go over to the record player and go, oh, I don't like that in 5 seconds. Now I have to find that little minuscule groove that gets me to the second track or, you know, the third track. Same thing with a tape. You'd have to just fast forward. And it was work to get to the next thing. And so artists were able to create things that were supposed to grow and morph into a new thing. And then you discover a new part of the song or the piece. You know, if you think about symphonic music, these things were written to be an experience in the moment that surprised you and changed along the way, not to be given a judgment call on the first two notes. And so I feel like that's what we're losing kind of across the board is just patience and calm. We have so many things bombarding us all the time, notifications and politics and news and noise that's around us that we don't really have time. We don't really make time for calm, which is really much more normal as a human. And so we're really living in a first generation of just a major shift in the way that our entire attention is supposed to work. And I think that's at least in that particular episode, I just wanted to remind people that music is meant to just be an experience and slow down, put on a record, you know, have dinner, sit down and just listen to an entire record, because that experience is unmatched.
Well, the idea of how easy it is to access sound and recordings, takes away the novelty for it. There's this an episode you did on the Watergate tapes, which I wanted to ask you about, because there's this moment here that I found really fascinating. And the Watergate tapes, what was great about, I think, this episode was that it wasn't just about the political dimension of Watergate, even though it is somewhat about that. You also talk about how those tapes, you know, those tapes that Richard Nixon those tapes that he was making in the White House were, you know, Johnny Cash and Ray Charles and other time. It's a time capsule is how you describe it. But you talk about how there was no internet, of course, at this time. There was no YouTube, no way to share the Watergate tapes when they first came out or to hear them outside of going to the courthouse to listen to them. And there's this man named Luke Nichter, who's written about the Watergate tapes, who talks about how novel it was to have to make this effort to hear these tapes. Here's another moment from 20,000 Hertz.
You read news accounts of the time. It's kind of fascinating. When the tapes were eventually used in litigation, people would wait up around the block of the courthouse. This could be the only time you can hear tapes. The news accounts were fascinating because people would wait all day, overnight. They'd sleep on the sidewalk to be one of the 55 or whatever it was who could sit in the public part of the courtroom. The press accounts are great because they say things like, today is the only time we will ever hear these conversations. Of course, now we look back 40 years later and think, well, thanks to the internet and technology, anybody can listen to these in their own homes or on their own mobile device. But at the time, this was so earth-shattering that a president had this veil of like a monarch. I think Watergate and the tapes, in a sense, tore the veil in half and made the president more human.
And it was like having to make an effort to hear those tapes made them matter more, almost. That's the way it came across to me in the podcast.
Yeah, I feel like that also kind of ties back in with records and analog and those the effort that it took to consume this stuff. And when we saw that there was value, whether it's monetary or time, to some sort of sound or recording, we naturally, I believe, as humans, take things more seriously. If you paid for something in some way, time, money, you perk up and you pay attention in a different way. But if you have nonstop, essentially free or subscription music and a infinite library of, news clips, we don't really take those sounds and words and music as seriously as we used to. And it's easy to just just not think about the importance of words and sounds and music because we don't have to put any effort in to getting them.
Dallas Taylor is with us. He's the host of the podcast 20,000 Hertz. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the podcast 20,000 Hertz with the creator and host, Dallas Taylor. One of the things the podcast really explores is just how powerful an effect sound has on us. And I wanted to have you talk a little bit about ASMR, which is one of those episodes that is, some people may absolutely know what this is. They may be obsessed by it and aware of it. Some may have no clue. But it's one of those episodes that you recommend people listen to on headphones, which I absolutely love. Talk a little bit about this show and this idea.
So one thing that we've discovered just as a team is that it's mind-blowing how little we know about how sound and hearing affects our brain.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty exciting to realize that there's still a lot to be discovered about how our brains work. And one thing that's become really fascinating is just the whole idea of synesthesia, which is like the cross-pollination of senses, where one sense kind of moves its way into another sense. For example, some people with sound can perceive or see colors with it. And sound can also change the way food tastes in the way that sounds are brought together. Things can become more bitter or become more sweet because of that. But ASMR is something that I had never heard about. And I just saw that on YouTube, there's these artists that have millions and millions and millions of fans doing these ASMR videos. And so what it is it's really sound crossing the barrier into touch. And I discovered that I have it, and it's something that even if I think about, I can feel. And the most common version of this is very gentle, quiet sounds that trigger a sensation that goes up your neck and kind of into the back of your head. And it's a really calming feeling. Some people seek it out, and just it can kind of happen over and over, and it just is really relaxing and some people think it has to do with the way that someone speaks to a baby, and it's kind of bringing up these senses of when we were children and babies and nurturing.
Can I play a bit?
Sure.
This is on your webpage for this episode. You've embedded a number of YouTube samples, and this is one. This comes from gentle whispering ASMR, just to give people who aren't familiar a sense. So not everyone is affected by this, but certain people are. What for those that are affected by it? It's a physiological reaction they're having to it.
Yeah, it's crossing into a different sense, which is mind blowing. For the people who do experience it, I mean this phenomenon, at least by name, is just incredibly new. I'm sure that people have had it and experienced it before, But now we're starting to put names to these things. And I in my own informal type of, you know, studies and just putting together the episode, it appears that there's, you know, kind of maybe 20-ish% of people who experience this. And you really have to be in a specific situation to experience it, because the visuals also help. And it has to be really, you have to be really calm and really only focusing on this. And if you're hearing this in the car, there's like too much going around. So really, like, headphones in a quiet place. And something in the brain is kind of jumping from that sense of hearing over to this sense of touch. And I always find just kind of that cross pollination of senses, you know, what is that from? Is it as an evolutionary thing? Like, are we changing? Maybe this was something that we needed, where maybe before our senses were more connected in a way where now we think of them as five senses, or are we moving toward that where our senses are more connected? Mm-hmm. I don't know. These are fascinating fringe things that we kind of got all the way up to the edge of what all the studies have done. And on the flip, there's a direct, at least the way that I look at it, is a direct flip side to this too, because there's also misophonia, which probably, if I was to guess, maybe 20 or 30% of people also have. Yeah. And that's a complete and utter disgust for some of these sounds, like chewing or any of these like repetitive noises. And so I found through the ASMR episode about misophonia, because so many people would either write in and say, I love this episode, it was so calming, I got the reaction, or it would be just as many people saying, I hate this. I had to turn it off. It's the first episode I ever had to turn off. And then we just kind of dug into that more and found that there's kind of a flip side on all of this. So I think it's just fascinating just being right on the bleeding edge of like understanding of what's happening with our brains in this stuff.
I want to ask you about the accent show. Was it interesting? I don't think it was a diversion, obviously, from sound, because accents are sounds for sure. But I wanted to ask you about this particular one. You say you love accents. Let's start with that. What is it you love about them? Because you explore the evolution of the accent, the English accent in particular. So explain what it is. What do you love about accents, and how do they relate to sound as you see it?
I just love the way people speak and how much history and again, like how things have changed in a relatively short amount of time. And I don't know exactly why I wanted to go down this. I've always just been somewhat fascinated, but I think I wanted to just discover, I had heard just on a tip somewhere that it was the British accent that evolved, not the American accent, and that the founders sounded more American as we would perceive it now than they did British.
Yeah.
And so I was just, I'm just fascinated in American history in general. And I think that what's great is if I can find an interest that I have in these other fields and kind of have a sound hook to it, then I can kind of discover it through my own unique expertise, I guess. And so that's really what I was trying to figure out. Like, why does the British sound the way that they do? Why do Americans sound the way that they do? And what's interesting, and like a lot of these episodes, is that opening up this idea, just it completely exploded the possibilities of additional ideas, additional dialects, and within just the U.S., there's so many different accents, and within the U.K., there's so many different accents, and that's just a tiny slither of the world. And so, just how they're regional, you can go a couple hundred miles in one direction, and it's totally different. And so I think that was like the highest level, top level thing that just opened up a whole, this could be an entire book, an entire study, an entire podcast just on accents and who and where they came from and what culturally influenced them.
Yeah. You have a scholar, Walt Wolfram, on the podcast, who says that everyone wants to be from somewhere. And I wonder... Yeah. What do you think we're seeing in terms of accents? And it seems like, I wonder if the same kind of concerns apply here that refer to the digital versus analog, you know, that because now there is such access and because technology is so extraordinary that some of these regional flavors of accents, some of these amazing dialects are maybe going to get stripped away in some ways. Do you worry about that?
Yeah. I had never thought about that before until we did the episode. And I'm from Arkansas, and you might be able to hear little things here or there in the way that I speak, but I've spent 20 plus years of my adult life stripping away all of where I came from, and it makes me sad. And I never thought about it because I think here in America we're doing the same thing where we're putting a non-regional dialect above other accents. It's or labeling or immediate thoughts of someone and what they believe based on the way that they speak or where they're from. And on the one hand, it's, you know, the world is getting closer. On the other hand, we're losing some of this local identity that we've had. And I think that the way that it affected me is I just feel like there's value on all of the different ways that people speak, and there's a history, and there's no difference in education or this and that. It's just a fascinating thing that sound, it's a living history that's happening through sound. And for myself, I feel guilty that I've really stripped that away. And it kind of makes me sad.
I want to ask about the episode on space. Talk a little bit. One of the things that you talk about, and there's that great line from the Alien movie used to market it, in space, no one can hear you scream. And basically, that's what you went in and did, was examined whether or not, in fact, that's true. Talk a little bit about the idea of space and how sound might or might not work in space.
Yeah. So with space, the space episode, again, I'm really into space and space travel and technology and all that. But I was trying to say something pretty big in that. So it was designed to just go through every planet in our solar system. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't immediately die because you were burned up or frozen or lack of atmosphere, what would this planet sound like?
Yeah.
And so typically atmospheric sciences is not an interesting pop culture topic. But I was trying to do I was doing an atmospheric sciences episode through the context of sound.
Yeah.
Because sound doesn't work, at least in the way that we perceive it at all, without an atmosphere to push those molecules around. And so we went through Mercury, where there's no atmosphere, so there's nothing. Venus, which the atmosphere is so thick and heavy that it would sound pretty warbly and difficult because you're trying to move so much pressure. Earth as we know it. Obviously, Mars, there would be a faint, faint whisper because it's such a light atmosphere.
I was really fascinated by this. And I think that if I played a moment from that episode, this would give people a sense of, because I loved this, you reached out to Scott Gusage at NASA, and you were talking to him about the film, the blockbuster film, The Martian. And he really said that he liked the film, but he talked to you about how they didn't quite get the sound right. And I wanted to play this moment because, and I was stunned by it, I have to say, in some ways. And I was trying to imagine what it would be like. Here's another moment from 20,000 Hertz.
Basically, the problem with what you saw in the movie there, where the atmosphere is so thick that it's picking up boulders and knocking things over, it's just not possible. I mean, the wind speed can get very high, you know, as high as hurricane force at the surface sometimes. So imagine 100-mile-per-hour wind on Earth if you were standing in a hurricane, and, you know, obviously you'd be almost blown off your feet. If you were standing on the surface there in Mars and you put your hand out in that 100-mile-per-hour wind, you'd feel it, but it would feel, you know, like a gentle breeze here on the surface of Earth.
That sounds pretty cool. Standing in a hurricane, but it only feels like a soft wind. But you'd die pretty quickly, right?
You wouldn't die instantaneously, but you'd want to be getting into shelter as fast as possible. First, the atmospheric pressure is dramatically lower than it is here on the surface of Earth. So all the water in your body would attempt to boil basically instantaneously. The water covering your eye, the water in your mouth, and even the water in your cells and your blood. And that wouldn't kill you right away, but it would be very uncomfortable immediately. You could probably survive for a few tens of seconds, maybe a minute. You could potentially get a very rapid dose of frostbite on your entire body. But again, you wouldn't necessarily die right away, but it'd be quick.
I love that part. And this is, it seems like in some ways, Venus, for example, pretty dense atmosphere. So it would be like being underwater. And the thing I learned from that podcast, and this was kind of the takeaway that you mentioned, is that you say in that show that our ears are a product of being human. So if you have some other life form, they would have a completely different perspective. Maybe they would have a whole different series of senses. And I hadn't, that had not occurred to me before.
Yeah, I think that when we think about other life or potential life, we always kind of put it from a human perspective. But as with most shows that I do, there's a bigger picture that I'm trying to paint that may not really be about sound at all.
Yeah.
So keep in mind, this podcast launched on November 1st, 2016, which was 8 days before the presidential election. Yet I have never talked politics in the show on purpose.
Right.
The show is completely clean because I want everyone to be involved. And I think that the space episode, what I'm trying to say that's in a big picture here is that we are together. We are all human. Our senses and our ears are in tune with this very tiny little ball flying through space. If you just keep going up a few miles, eventually sound goes away, and it goes away forever until you find something that might be somewhat resemblant of this, of what Earth's like, which, you know, we have speculation that there could be things out there. But for our purposes, it's infinitely never again.
Yeah.
So in that particular, by doing that illustration and going through every planet, I was just trying to say that, like, we're human. We're all in it together. Like, we're all of the same, you know, we're all the same together, and we're all in it together. Mm-hmm. And our ears are just a product of proving that in this thin, thin, tiny little layer of atmosphere that we're tied to this Earth.
I mean, it's like sound connects us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't know if we found life somewhere else, I would be skeptical that they would perceive the same frequencies as us. Even here on Earth, there's animals that hear totally different frequencies. And even with sight, like there's animals that see completely different colors and can see different bands. And I'm sure that for taste and touch and smell, there's probably the same. So if you zoom way out and you look at humans, I mean, we look at everything as from a human perspective, but if you zoom out and think about, like, that all of our senses are completely different for other animals and maybe other beings or whatnot, then it's really obvious that, like, we're all in it together. We're the same. Like, there is no race or, you know, any of these things. It's just we're human, and we're very unique and special. And I think our ears and the way that we perceive sound is a proof of that.
When you first mentioned this idea for the podcast to people in the early days, some wondered, aren't you going to run out of ideas? And as you mentioned earlier, you've got plenty. What's next that you're thinking about? And I'm wondering if you're seeing any bigger themes that you're trying to explore. And do you feel like in some ways the show is kind of changing or evolving in ways?
Yeah. There was a reason that I made the tagline, "The world's most recognizable and interesting sounds," because I didn't want it just to be recognizable sounds. I wanted to also have the freedom to explore science and just sound ideas. And so I feel like it's the show has fallen into four categories of shows. It's either recognizable. So these are things like the THX Deep Note or the Amen Break or, you know, the Emergency Alert System or UI or NBC. There's interesting concepts like, you know, live theater and Muzak and Disney parks and spooky sounds, and kind of these are more general concepts under an umbrella. And then there's like science, and then there's misophonia or ASMR or the way that we talk or crying. And then there's like, I don't know if activism is the right word, but just kind of like, here's how sound could be benefiting your life or making it worse. And so these are things like ultrasonic tracking or audio descriptions or noise pollution or the way that we're boat traffic is kind of disrupting undersea life.
Yeah.
But as far as the future, I feel like we're very much on a fringe place with synesthesia in general, the cross-pollination of senses. So there's a lot more to kind of dig into in there, but there are still like very just interesting concepts and just cartoon sounds and jingles and sonic branding and specific sounds under those umbrellas. And the great thing is like there's just so many incredible concepts and incredible stories that a lot of people just don't cover because we don't think much about hearing, that I feel like we just have the pick of any way we want to tell them and whatever the most interesting hook is that we have that. So I think we're still going to do a lot of science things, sonic illusions, how that works in our brain. I love space, so we're going to do a show on the Voyager Golden Record and what that means for humanity, which will probably tie back to that space episode in some ways. But yeah, I think it's going to be kind of falling into those four categories and hopefully programming it in a way where it's not one of those categories in a row.
Yeah. It's Dallas Taylor, founder and creative director of De Facto Sound and host, of course, of the podcast 20,000 Hertz. Dallas, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tess Goodwin. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. Program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.